All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Sri Prabhupada. Nama Om Vishnu Vinaya Krishna Prasthaya Vipulashi Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nati Mati. Namaste Sarasvati Deve Gauranga Vichani Nirsay Sisuri Nirsay Chari Sita. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Uttapada Kamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavascha. Sri Rupam Sarvajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Yitam Stamasachivam. Sadvaitam Sarvadutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Deva Sri Radha Krishna Param Sahagana Ravita Sri Vishakam Vidhishtha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. In Auckland, New Zealand, reading from Canto 8, Chapter 4, Gajendra Returns to the Spiritual World, Text 6. Gajendra Bhagavat Sparshad Vimukto Gnana Bandhavat Prapto Bhagavato Rupam Pitavasa Chaturbhuja. Before we repeat it, this is a very simple verse, so we can probably figure out the meaning and meditate on the meaning while we're chanting it. So, some idea what the first line means?
Gajendra is a disciple of Bhagavat. Gajendra is a disciple of Bhagavat.
Well, we don't, not disciple. What does sparsha mean? Touch. So, what is Gajendra Bhagavat sparsha? Yes, the gender is touched by Krishna. Then vimukto jnana bandhanat. So vimukta, mukti means liberation. Bandha means what? Bound. So jnana bandha would mean, actually it's ajnana. So vimukto ajnana, you have the apostrophe there. So ajnana means what? Not knowledge, ignorance. So ajnana bandha would mean? Be bound by ignorance. Vimukto ajnana bandhavat would mean?
Liberated
from the bondage of ignorance. Then prapta, what does prapti mean? You have prapti city. It's one of the opulences, one of the mystic opulences, prapti city. You can reach out your hand and grab a mango from the other side of the planet. So what does prapti mean?
Gaining.
Bandhavato rupam. What's rupam mean? Form. So what would that whole line mean? Gaining a form like the Lord. So anybody knows what that's called? Sarupya Mukti. Okay, then Pitava. So what does Pita mean? Yeah? No, that's Pita. Pita. Pitavas. Yellow. You say yellow? Oh, it is yellow. And vas, like vastra. Clothes. So pita vas, yellow clothes. Chatur is?
Four.
Bhujaha is? Hands. So somebody tell me what the whole verse means.
That's like, because Krishna wears yellow, and says that it's performed by having this kind of form.
Well, the last two lines refer to what Gajendra looks like now. So the first two lines are what happened to him, and the last two lines are now what he looks like. So can anyone tell me what this verse means? Yes? Yes, does everybody hear that? Okay, so if you look at the verse, it's Gajendra Bhagavan Sparsha. Gajendra is touched by Bhagavan. Vimukto, he becomes liberated from ajnana bandhava. He becomes liberated from the bondage of ignorance. Prapto he gets Bhagavato Rupam, a form like Bhagavan, Pitavasa, that's dressed in yellow garments, Chatur Bhujaha, that has four hands. Okay, so now you can chant with knowledge. Okay, someone chant the verse, please. Gajendra Bhagavat Basha. Gajendra. The king of the elephants, Gajendra. By the way, the word Gajendra literally means king of the elephants. Indra means chief, and Gaja means elephants. So you have Gaja, Indra. The A and E becomes E, so Gajendra. Bhagavat Sparshat. Because of being touched by the hand of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Vimuktaha was immediately free. Agyana bandhanat. From all kinds of ignorance, especially the bodily concept of life. Praptaha, achieved. Bhagavataha, of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Rupam, the same bodily features. Pichavasaha, wearing yellow garments. Chatuhu Bhujaha, and four-handed with conch shell, disc, club, and lotus. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Because Gajendra, king of the elephants, had been touched directly by the hands of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he was immediately freed of all material ignorance and bondage. Thus he received the salvation of Swarupya Mukti, in which he achieved the same bodily features as the Lord, being dressed in yellow garments and possessing four hands. Purport. If one is favored by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, by having his gross body touched by the Lord, his body turns into a spiritual body, and he can go back home, back to Godhead. Gajendra assumed a spiritual body when his body was touched by the Lord. Similarly, Dhruva Maharaj assumed his spiritual body in this way. Archana Padati, daily worship of the deity, provides an opportunity to touch the body of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and thus it enables one to be fortunate enough to get a spiritual body and go back to Godhead. Not only by touching the body of the Supreme Lord, but simply by hearing about his pastimes, chanting his glories, touching his feet, and offering worship. In other words, by serving the Lord somehow or other, one is purified of material contamination. This is the result of touching the Supreme Lord. One who is a pure devotee, anyabhilashita sunyam, who acts according to the Shastra and the words of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, certainly becomes purified like Gajendra. He assumes a spiritual body and returns home back to Godhead. Gajendra Bhagavat Sparshad Vimokto Gyanabandhanat Prapto Bhagavato Rupam Pitavasat Turabhuja. Because Gajendra, king of the elephants, had been touched directly by the hands of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he was immediately freed of all material ignorance and bondage. Thus he received the salvation of Swarupya Mukti, in which he achieved the same bodily features as the Lord, being dressed in yellow garments and possessing four hands. So we have this word sparsha, which means touch. So this reminds us of the verse in Bhagavad Gita 5:22. Yehi samsparsha jabhoga dukha yona ayanevate adyanta pata kuntaya nate shri ramate bhaga. So samsparsha ja bhoga. Sparsha ja, ja means birth, bhoga, the happiness that is born from touch. Dukkha yoni gives birth to misery. Why? Adyananta, it has a beginning, adi, and anta, it has an end. Therefore, nate shu ramate buddha. Buddha, the wise people, don't get rama, don't get pleasure from the happiness born of touch. So here we have two kinds of touch, the materialistic touch and the spiritual touch. But in both cases, it's touch. Now, touch doesn't just mean the skin. Just like Srila Prabhupada in his purport, he's saying spiritual touch. First, he talks about touching the deity. And then he says, not just Satyamadevi, but any devotional service is putting you in touch with Krishna. So when we say happiness born of touch, we don't just mean happiness on the skin. But all of the senses have to touch their sense object in order to experience happiness. Light has to touch my eyes, the sound waves has to touch my ears, the odor has to touch my nose, the food has to touch my tongue or touch my stomach, and so forth. There has to be a contact, a touch, between the object of the senses and the senses. And generally in this world, we consider that that's happiness. Samsparsha ja bhoga. What is happiness? When my senses touch their objects. Or a little higher than that, Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains that there's three levels of rasa. One is bodily, one is mental emotional, and the other is spiritual. So mental emotional is when I connect mentally and emotionally rather than physically. I was talking to some devotees who plan to get married, and they were saying, how can we best connect with each other? And that's what we want to do. We want to have some sort of a connection. You know, husband and wife want to have a connection through physical touch, but that's not enough. They want to connect also emotionally. They want to understand each other. They want to feel some affection for each other. And in fact, just the physical sensations without the emotional are not really very satisfying. I mean, even animals want some emotional relationship. You know, when you walk down the street here and the horses come to the gate, they're looking for two things. They're looking for food, and they're looking for someone to pet them. And pet them not just the sensation of physical touch, but they're looking for that physical touch as a way of demonstrating affection. So if you think about it, all of our concepts of happiness involve some sort of connection, either a gross physical connection or a subtle mental and emotional connection, and preferably both. We like to have, just like we like to eat with our friends. In at least every culture of the world that I know of, eating is often a social event. You eat with your family, you eat with your friends. Solitary eating is not as desirable. So we like the taste of the touch of the food, but also the subtle touch of people that we like, or people that we love. But Krishna says that that kind of touch, dukkha yona, yoni means birth. So it gives birth to misery. And of course, this is one of the first surprising instructions that one hears in the Hare Krishna movement, because out in the world, we're told that this is happiness, that happiness is seeing something beautiful, smelling something attractive, tasting something good, touching something soft and pleasing, right? Hearing attractive music and having a subtle emotional connection. That's what we're told. That's what happiness is. And the whole reason that people work and make money and so is to have this sort of thing, gross and subtle. And that's all there is. And if you complain about it and say, well, that's not fully satisfying, people will say, well, that's all there is. Why don't you just enjoy it? And, you know, when you come to the Hare Krishna movement, what's one of the first things you're told is that's not actual happiness. And Krishna explains one reason here. Adyantavanta. Ad and anta, adyanta. It has a beginning and it has an end. So even if you have a delicious meal, it has a beginning and it has an end. Right now, none of us are eating. So we may have had a wonderful meal yesterday, but that pleasure sensation is now gone. We can remember, you know, I ate this, what did we have yesterday? What was that, wonton soup? So I can remember that I ate wonton soup, and I can somewhat remember the taste, but I can't really re-experience it, can I? Can you re-experience, think of something really nice you ate, a piece of cake or something? But not really. Or you smell some nice flower. How do you re-experience it? You know, you can sort of meditate on it. But it's more I'm thinking about that I enjoyed it rather than I can really re-enjoy it. I can't hold on to it. It starts somewhere and it ends somewhere. But that's not what we want. We're looking for continuous enjoyment. Aren't we looking for continuous enjoyment? Does anyone want their enjoyment to end? No. Whatever enjoyment it is, subtle enjoyment, gross enjoyment, all the varieties of subtle enjoyment, all the varieties of gross enjoyment, we want it to go on forever. Not only do we want it to go on forever, we want it to keep getting better. Now, that's another problem with material touch. It gets boring. You know, you have pizza for breakfast, lunch, dinner, breakfast, lunch, dinner, breakfast, lunch, dinner, breakfast. I don't know why you don't want to eat pizza anymore. You want to eat something else. It's just, it doesn't have the same kick, is it? That's why we do something called Bhoga Tyaga. Tyaga means to renounce. In order to enjoy material things, you actually have to have an end. You have to get away from them so that they seem fresh when you go back to them again. And you have to have a vacation from them. You can't enjoy contentment. Try it. Try taking, having some material pleasure continuously. After a while, you're like, yeah, I need a break. I mean, even people you really love, you don't want to be with them every single minute of the day. Or maybe people think that way when they first fall in love or something, but after a while they say, okay, I need my own space too. So why is that? Because material enjoyment satiates us. It gets to a point and no more. But that's not what we want. We want something, first of all, that has no beginning and no end, and then we want something that doesn't satiate us, that continues to provide the same kick or better with time. At least the same. But we prefer we get better. And we read about the marriage of Usha and Aniruddha and how their love grew by 4 times every day. That's what everybody hopes for, you know, when you make a friend, when you marry someone, when you have a child, when you serve somebody, you hope that the relationship will increase, but generally it decreases. Usually, people, after they're married for 10 or 20 years, they don't feel that same extreme romantic love that they felt when they got married. It's decreased. It's gone to something sort of comfortable. And with your children, you know, you're so attached to your children when they're born. You know, after they're 20, 30 years old, you don't feel like that. When they're little tiny babies, you don't want to be away from them for a moment. And when they're 30, you know, you can go for a week or two without talking to them and you don't feel like you're dying. It decreases. And then there's another problem with material touch, and that is it's not touching us. It's not touching the soul. It's just the body and the mind, which is not us. So this is compared to the bird in the cage. You're cleaning the cage and you're not feeding the bird. And of course, this is why you can get all kinds of material enjoyment and then you say, that's it? That's all there is? I was talking to one devotee yesterday who said, you know, I got a great education. I think he has 3 master's degrees. I got a really good education. I got a great job. Really interesting job, a lot of prestige, as much money as I wanted, and it was all empty. And this is why you see that sometimes people who get, you know, they're beautiful, they're famous, they're rich, they're intelligent, they're strong, they have all these material opulences, and they end up taking drugs or alcohol or even committing suicide. Obviously not all of them, but if material enjoyment was satisfying, we would expect that every single person, or at least, you know, 95% of people who got material enjoyment would be happy. Is that the case? Are 95% of the famous, rich, beautiful movie stars and music stars and sports stars, are they happy? No. I don't know what the percentage is, but it certainly isn't 95%. Every day you can read in the news how one of them is, you know, addicted to some sort of intoxicant, which is a good sign of being unhappy. People don't take intoxicants because they're happy. They take intoxicants because they're miserable. Or they're divorced, or they're beating their wife, or, right? Is it? Sometimes they even commit suicide, they're so unhappy. So So why is that? I mean, we've all experienced this, that there's something material that we wanted, and we got it, and it was great, and we said, that's it? That's it? So why is that? Because it's not touching me. There's a touch going on. You know, there's a touch going on with my skin, or there's a touch going on with my mind, but it never penetrates down to me. It's like if you're hot and sweaty and you're in your car and someone's washing your car, but you don't feel refreshed. You may get some indirect enjoyment. Oh, now I have a nice shiny car. But Krishna says this enjoyment is mental concoction. I have a nice shiny car, so I must be happy. But you're not directly feeling happiness like you do when you take a shower. You know, if I watch a movie of people eating, I may feel some sort of indirect happiness, but that's not the same as if I eat. So all the happiness for this body and this mind, they're all indirect. They're all just by mental concoction. I'm thinking, I'm touching this nice thing, I'm eating this nice thing, I'm seeing, but we're not. And Krishna also explains this in the 5th chapter and the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. I'm not doing any of these things. I'm witnessing, just like watching a movie. Watching a movie, the character does all these things. I'm not doing them. I get pleasure by identifying with the character. But I'm not actually doing those things, or in a dream. Right? The Shastra often compares material happiness to a dream. So those are the three reasons why happiness born of touch doesn't satisfy us. It has a beginning and end. We get satiated. We get bored. We have to move away from it. By the way, I should mention that sometimes when people move away from it, they think they're very renounced. You know, fasting after a huge feast is not renunciation. Right? After your girlfriend dumps you and runs off with your best friend, saying, I'm going to be a brahmachari, you know, that's not real renunciation. It's just disgust with material enjoyment. And everyone, every materialist goes through a bodhicitta cycle. Enjoy, renounce, enjoy, renounce, enjoy, renounce, enjoy, everybody. So when you're in the renunciation part of that cycle, you're not actually renounced. That's necessary for so-called material enjoyment. So it has a beginning and end. It satiates, so we have to move back from it to make it appear new and fresh. And it's superficial. It's inauthentic. It's phony. It's not, we're not actually enjoying it. Therefore, dukkha yoni. It's a source of misery. It's a source of lamentation. The very things that we think are going to give us happiness end up giving us sorrow. You know, how many songs are there about why did my love leave me? You know, why did it end? Or even if the one you love doesn't leave you, they die. Something happens, or you die. Why did it leave me? Or why wasn't it satisfying? And simply lamenting. But our Krishna conscious philosophy is not, therefore, give up happiness born of touch. Our philosophy is get the real happiness born of touch. We are not a negative philosophy. We say, instead of watching a movie about somebody eat, why don't you go eat? That's our philosophy. So the people who are absorbed in watching the movie, they think that we're being very negative. We say, instead of watching the hero in the movie fall in love, and watching the hero in the movie eat a big meal, and watching the hero in the movie get some money, why don't you actually fall in love and actually eat something and actually get some money? Get out of the movie theater and come to real life. And all the people watching the movie, they're like, boy, you guys are really austere, aren't you? You're giving up enjoyment. We're like, no, we're not giving up enjoyment. We're giving up an illusion of enjoyment and getting real enjoyment. You're the austere ones. Yeah, I once saw a teenage boy who was so absorbed in a computer game, he didn't eat or drink or shower for 15 hours. his family was visiting us. You know, we had to practically drag him from the computer to feed him by the end of the day. So that's Maya. We're absorbed in something that's not real. Now, why do we do that? Because we don't know about the reality, and we're afraid that if I take my attention away from Maya, I'll have nothing. Better to have an unsatisfying, temporary illusion than nothing. That's our fear. You know, and that's the materialist argument. They'll say, well, that's all there is. Even if you can convince a materialist that it's lousy, and sometimes you can, often they'll say, but that's all there is. There isn't anything else. And modern philosophies, modern scientists, modern education, television, commercials, they've really done a good job at indoctrinating people that this is all there is. There's just nothing more. You are this body. You are your brain. Someday we'll have brain transplants, so when you're dying, we'll put your brain into a young body and you'll go on living. You know, they've convinced us like this, that you are the body. And we say, well, it's not really satisfying being the body. They say, well, but sorry, that's all there is. And they say, anyone who tells you there's something more, they're the phonies. Anyone who preaches religion or spirituality or some sort of ultimate spiritual enjoyment, they're just fooling you. Don't go there. That's the opiate of the people. Don't leave the movie theater. Just stay here watching movies. There's no life outside the movie theater. There's only the movie theater. That's all. Why? So then you'll watch it and you'll buy their products and then they can have their movie enjoyment too. So we say, no, there's something else. There's another kind of touch. And here we see this other kind of touch. Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, in his commentary on this verse, said that first Gajendra was touching the Lord with his mind and his voice. So in his prayers that we already finished reading, he was meditating on the Lord with his mind and he was speaking about the Lord. And that was also touch. When we talk about touch, we're talking about connection. Connection, the Sanskrit word for connection is yoga. Right? So he was in yoga with the Supreme, with his mind and with his voice, and from that, the Lord came and touched his gross body, at which time his gross body dissolved and he assumed his Vaikuntha form. So here again you see the reality. We're not this body, but we do have a spiritual body who we are. We're not saying, I'm not this body, therefore I'm nothing. I mean, there are people who preach like that. There are also other spiritual movements that say you're not the body, or you're not the body, you're not the mind. And what do they say you are? You're nothing. Or you're just light. But we say, no, you're something. I mean, here he has a body that's something. It has four arms, it has yellow garments, it looks like the Lord. So that's the result of spiritual touch. The result of spiritual touch, first of all, touches the real self. It's not just touching the externals. In fact, as soon as the Lord touches the gender's external body, elephant body, immediately he was touching the soul instead. There was the spiritual body. And this touch of the material mind and the material voice to Krishna's body, immediately it made a direct spiritual connection. It starts to dissolve, as we have here, vimukto ajnana bandhanat. It's dissolving the gross and subtle material body. That is liberation, that the material mind is dissolved. That doesn't leave you mindless. It activates then the spiritual mind, the spiritual body, which of course are non-dual. It's not that there's a difference between the soul and the spiritual body and the spiritual mind. The spiritual body and spiritual mind is the expansion of the soul, is the exhibition of the soul's love. So this is what we want to do. Now what's really ironic is that engaging in spiritual touch appears to be externally very much like material touch. I'm eating prasadam. Well, that looks like I'm eating food. I'm touching the body of the deity. Prabhupada talks here in this purport about touching the body of the deity. That appears my gross hand is touching some apparently material object. Or all these other things Prabhupada's talking about, chanting his glory, I'm speaking. People are speaking about so many things. It appears to be the same, which is why materialists don't get it. They say, well, you know, you're doing the same things that we're doing. But it's not. And what's the difference? What makes it different? What makes it different when we're addressing the deity, when we're eating prasadam, when we're cleaning the floor, when we're reading the shastra, from people getting pleasure through contact with their gross senses and with their mind?
The mood.
The mood, the consciousness. Now, of course, some things are, the deity is actually Krishna. So even if you have the wrong mood, still worshipping the deity gives you benefit. Just like if you take medicine with the wrong mood, it still helps you. Of course, if you take medicine with the right mood, it helps you more. And some people are helped even by taking phony medicine with the right mood. They call that the placebo effect. So everyone knows that mood is important when taking medicine. But if you take real medicine, well, even if you don't know it, it still has an effect on you. So having contact directly with things, even supposedly material, that have become spiritualized through the process of bhakti, have an effect on people even if they don't know it. It starts to dissolve this material bondage, it starts to dissolve the material illusion, and starts to awaken the real self. But one comes to a point, one must come to a point, of doing those things with the proper consciousness. So doing those things externally is meant to bring you to the point of doing them with the proper consciousness. And if you can do them with the proper consciousness from the beginning, then the progress is very fast. And this is, it's really a very slight change. This is a very, very slight change. So I'm cleaning the floor thinking, this is my floor, and I want the pleasure of a clean floor. I want the pleasure when I walk on the floor that it feels clean, that I don't get grit on my feet. And when I look at the floor, it looks clean. So that's enjoyment of touch. I'm trying to enjoy the touch of my skin on the floor and the cleanliness on my eye. I'm thinking it's my floor for me to enjoy, and therefore I'm cleaning it. Or I'm thinking I'm cleaning this floor because it's Krishna's floor and he wants to look at a clean floor. And when he wants, when he walks around, you know, he does walk around again. You know that. This is the new Varshana. This is Krishna's pastime place. So when Krishna walks around, he wants it to be clean. And he wants to see that it's clean. And my pleasure comes from the fact that he's pleased with it, rather than directly. Which is interesting, because material pleasure is indirect, isn't it? It's not direct. Material pleasure is not direct pleasure. It's indirect pleasure. It's mental concoction. It's, I believe I am enjoying something, but I'm not actually enjoying it. It's just going to the body and mind. And spiritual pleasure is also indirect. Spiritual pleasure is I'm happy that Krishna's happy. That should give you a little indication that our natural constitutional position is to have indirect pleasure. We're meant to enjoy vicariously. That's how we're constituted. That's what it means we're meant to serve. We're not. That's what it means that we're not the enjoyers. We enjoy, but our enjoyment comes indirectly. And we have a little idea of that in this world, that I get a much higher enjoyment from pleasing someone else than from pleasing myself directly. I get much more fun giving you something or doing something for you, if I love you, and seeing your happiness at what I've done, than if I put that same energy into doing something for myself. Don't you all have that experience? It doesn't make any logical sense. You know, why should spending $100 on a gift for you give me more happiness than spending $100 for myself? But it does. When I spend that money for you and you say, wow, oh, what's this wonderful, exactly what I wanted, and you're beaming in happiness, I feel so gratified. And it even extends. You know, why do people spend money to feed, you know, starving people? Because it's very satisfying. You know, when you know that some poor child somewhere got an education and got clothing and medical care because of something you did, and you get the little picture of your child in the mail, and you feel very satisfied. That's actually, it's our ultimate satisfaction, which is the goal we have in all of our human relationships, by the way. Why does a man work hard? Because he wants his wife to be happy because of him. He wants to be the catalyst. He wants to be the reason for her happiness. I mean, he wants her to just be happy too, but he wants her to be happy because of him. And why does the woman serve the husband? She wants him to be happy because of her. She wants him to say, wow, this is a great meal. Oh, the house looks so clean. Why do we do things for our friends? Same thing. So, but when the source of our happiness, of our indirect happiness, is the body and mind, it's not satisfying. When the source of our indirect happiness is Krishna, it's satisfying. Because I'm not really part of the body and mind, but I'm really part of Krishna. So when he's satisfied, I'm naturally satisfied. It's real. If I think by satisfying my family I'll be happy, that's not real. I'm not actually part of my family. I'm part of my family just by connection of the body. I'm not the body. If I think by serving my country I'll be happy, that's not real, because I'm not really part of my country. My last life I was part of another country. My life before that I was part of another country. So no matter how much I serve my country, I don't have a real connection with my country. I don't have a real connection with this body and mind. I don't have a real connection with my family or my job. Or, you know, my group of friends. But I have a real connection with Krishna. I have a real eternal connection with Krishna. So when Krishna's happy, I actually feel genuine happiness. And that's just the difference. I'm cleaning the floor so that Krishna will smile and he'll have a nice place to walk. And then I feel so happy. I'm cleaning and thinking, wow, Krishna's looking at this floor and smiling. Prabhupada said, the residents of Vrindavan, they just want to see Krishna smile. That's all. I just want that Krishna's happy. And somehow Krishna's pleased. That's our whole goal, that Krishna's pleased with what I do. Not just that Krishna's pleased in a general, generic way, because Krishna's always pleased. Krishna's not sorrowful. He's always full of joy. He's a source of all joy. But I want Krishna to be pleased with me. I want Krishna to recognize me. Not recognize me, oh, you're a great hero. But recognize me, oh, what a great servant you are. What a wonderful friend you are. What a wonderful lover you are. What a wonderful parent you are. That's the recognition. Like Akura said, Krishna will call me Uncle Akura, and then my whole life will be successful. Prabhupada said there, one should work to be recognized by Krishna, or his life is condemned. So the desire to be recognized by the world, why is the devotee detached from that? Because he knows that's false. And he wants to be recognized by Krishna, which is real. Why is the devotee detached from material sense objects? Because he's getting pleasure from Krishna contacting sense objects. Because of what he's done. I've cooked something, and Krishna's enjoying what I've cooked. I've cleaned something, Krishna's enjoying what I've cleaned. I've told people about Krishna, and Krishna's enjoying that. And how happy I am to see that Krishna's happy because of something that I've done. And when we do that, then we become also who we are. Once we start getting pleasure that's real, then guess what? We become real. The false things fall away. Why do I have these false things? Because I'm getting pleasure that's false. If I'm attached to getting pleasure that's false, I have to maintain a false vehicle and a false identity to get false pleasure. If you're going to watch the movie, you have to sit in the theater. Of course, now they're going to make movies that you can watch on glasses that you walk around with. Maybe they've already done it. If I want to have false pleasure, I have to identify with a false body and mind. And as soon as I start getting my enjoyment in a real way, what do I need the false vehicle for? I don't need it anymore. And my real self Because that's what I'm wanting. I'm wanting real pleasure, and that activates my real self. So as we continually, over and over and over and over again, take our pleasure in a real way, as Prabhupada's saying here, then we become free from ignorance and our reality will manifest. Generally, gradually. Not always, but generally, gradually. The reason for that is that our engagement in real pleasure generally also happens gradually. So that's our process in a nutshell. Instead of trying to get pleasure by touching, whether through seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, or through emotions, the things of this world, for my own pleasure directly, or for the pleasure of my body and mind, thinking it's direct, but it's actually indirect. Instead, get the spiritual indirect pleasure, which then becomes genuinely direct. So materially, I think it's direct. I think I'm pleasing myself directly, but I'm not. I'm just pleasing the body and mind, and it's actually indirect and unsatisfying. Spiritually, I think it's indirect. I think I'm not taking care of myself anymore. I'm just pleasing Krishna. But that becomes a genuinely direct experience. And Prabhupada explains this in the end of the Bhagavad Gita about the disciplic succession, that although you're hearing through the guru, it's a direct experience. It's not a mitigated experience. He's a transparent Vaiyamya. Transparent, I mean, even a window's not fully transparent, but completely transparent. So although there's an intermediary, it's direct. So this is the strange nature of illusion. When I think I'm getting direct enjoyment, I'm getting indirect enjoyment, and it's unsatisfying. When I go for the actual thing, it appears to be indirect, but the experience is direct. And the experience is real and actually satisfying and without a beginning or an end. So, of course, we should do this externally, Prabhupada says, according to the Shastra. Who acts according to the Shastra and the words of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So we start with that. I follow the words of the Shastra. The Shastra says, take your good food and offer it to Krishna first. Okay, and I do that. That means I have to have a certain kind of food. It has to be vegetarian food. And I have to cook it in a certain way. I don't eat it while I'm cooking. I have to be clean while I'm cooking. And I have to have some kind of an altar and a special plate. And I put it on and I say certain prayers. And I do certain external behaviors, or I have a deity and I dress the deity in a certain way according to the Shastra. That has to be there. That's like the vehicle. But what's really going on, what really needs to happen, is a change in consciousness. I'm doing this to make Krishna smile. I'm doing this for Krishna's pleasure. My enjoyment will be the fact that Krishna is pleased, rather than my trying to enjoy directly. Rather than, this is mine, and I'm going to try to enjoy it directly. So it's a very slight change. And it's not a difficult change. It's difficult because we're habituated to doing it the other way. Whenever one changes a habit, there's some, what do you call it? Struggle. Right? Because you have some habit. But it's not, in principle, it's not a difficult thing to do. It's actually a very, very slight change. And the externals of a devotee's life, in many ways, are not that different. And we do that, and we will also get our spiritual body. Actually, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur also says that this verse is the fulfillment of Gajendra's prayers in 8.3.19. Where he says, Vimokshanam, I want to get moksha, I want to get liberation. I want to get my, that was what Gajendra wanted. Please, Lord, come and give me my spiritual body. And that's what he got. So we should also have our goal in our service. We shouldn't be goalless, just kind of going on from day to day without a goal. I mean, frankly, that's an animal. An animal's just going on from day to day, where's food, where's shelter, where's sex, you know, how to get away from my enemies. An animal doesn't have some overall goal in life, or even a goal for the week. They just kind of have an immediate physical needs. So we should have a goal. Prabhupada said there should be a goal for the mind. So we can have an immediate goal. We were talking the other day on Prabhupada's disappearance day of having a goal of service. What service can I offer for the mission? What goal really inspires me to do for Mahaprabhu's mission? And we should have an ultimate internal goal. I want to become who I am. I want to realize who I am. I want to realize who I am as one of Krishna's associates in Goloka Vrindavan, and I want to regain my original service. I want to regain my original relationship with Krishna. That should be our inner goal. That should be our prayer. At all times, Krishna, I want to please you. And I know the ultimate way to please you is to become again who I am and establish our original relationship. That's really what Krishna wants. I mean, Krishna's happy that we clean the floor and Krishna's happy that we give him nice flowers. But ultimately, what Krishna's going to be happy with is we become again who we are. You know, if you have some family member that you've become estranged from and your relationship with them has become broken, you might be happy if they send you flowers and send you a card and send you some money, but what you really want is reestablishment of the relationship. So that's the ultimate way to make Krishna. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions? That's a very good question. How can we have ultimate goals if we don't have that much faith? Well, then have an intermediate goal. Have a goal that's up to the level of your faith. That's okay. And keep moving your goal as your faith increases. The progression of Krishna consciousness can be understood as a progression of faith, a deepening of faith. I did a home program last night. Unfortunately, we both got to bed after 11 o'clock. I do occasionally get programs where I ask people to write down what is their biggest doubt in Krishna consciousness, what is their biggest challenge in practicing Krishna consciousness, what's the biggest problem in their life. And I was surprised at how many people wrote down, I have no doubts at all. I have complete faith. One of them wrote down, I have unconditional love for Krishna. And I said, you know, if that's true, then you're going to be experiencing unlimited, ever-existent ecstasy. I said, that's your evidence procedure. And it's far better, what you're saying, I really appreciate it, it's far better to acknowledge that I have only partial faith, because then you can work on it. If you think that, you know, you're already there, you're not going to really do anything to get there because you're already there. So we have to be honest and work at our level of faith, our level of attachment. It's actually a disturbance to work at a level that's either lower or higher than we are. Does that make sense? But you should at least theoretically understand what the top goal is. So when you're working, you know, in third grade in school, you know that the top goal is to graduate. You know you're not going to graduate anytime soon, but you know that that's your goal is to graduate. But then you have an immediate goal to get that math lesson done for today, to move on to the next grade. And when you're in third grade, it's not good to do second grade work, and it's not good to do fourth grade work. Is that right? So at least in theory, at least I have in theory that my ultimate goal is to realize who I am. My ultimate goal is to realize I'm one of Krishna's parents or friends or gopis or cows. You know, I have my eternal identity. And to be, again, serving in that eternal identity, both while I'm in this body and ultimately after the demise of this body. That's my ultimate goal, is to regain my eternal service and to regain my relationship with Krishna and to fully realize who I am. That will give me everything I want. And I may have an intermediate goal of just not yelling at my kids today. or reading the Shastra with more attention. But also it's good to have some goal and service for Mahaprabhu's mission besides just let me read Prabhupada's books with attention today. Something where we're really wanting to offer our spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, something that's near and dear to our heart. Something that's our nature, our propensities, something that we really love. So some of us, I'm sure, are already doing that, and if we're not already doing that, then that's something that we should focus on. What would I like to offer to Krishna? Is that okay? Thank you for asking. Yes. To what?
Faith.
How do we know that Krishna will take care of us? Well, have you always had food? Have you ever starved? Have you always had shelter from the elements? Clothes? Friends? Have you had just exactly what you need, or do you usually have even more than what you need? Right now, do you have exactly as many clothes as you need or more? You probably have more, don't you? Are you given just exactly as much food as you need or more? More. What about the varieties of food? Are you given just the basic variety of food you need to maintain life, or a bigger variety of food? Do you have just the bare minimum number of friends to be sane, or do you have more friends? Do you have, you know, just barely enough service to keep you busy, or do you have more service than you could possibly do in your lifetime if you wanted to do it? Do you have just enough shastra that you could, you know, barely have some, do you have more shastra than you could possibly ever read? I mean, I don't think I could ever read all the Hare Krishna books anymore. I used to be able to, but now there's so many, you know, you just can't keep up with them. The devotees are writing and translating more books all the time. You know, you could buy all of them if you're rich enough, but it's kind of hard to read all of them, unless that's all you want to do. Has Krishna given you the help to make advancement when you needed it, and when you were ready for it, somehow or other? So whenever you're ready to take the next step, does he give you that realization and that instruction? Not always when you want it, but when he knows you're ready for it. Does he do that? Does he do that in kind of wonderful ways? Sometimes people tell you, sometimes you read it in a purport, sometimes it's just in your heart, and you go, wow. Right? Does he do that? So Krishna's providing everything we need. Now, sometimes it doesn't look like that. Sometimes something that I think I need or that I want, I don't get. And sometimes I get things that I don't want. You know, I break my leg, or get sick, or I lose my money, or somebody insults me. And we'll look at this on Thursday. You know, the reverses in life, and how the reverses in life are also what we need, and also a way that Krishna is taking care of us. Now again, we can often, I don't want to talk about this too much today, but we can often see that looking back. You know, when I look back, I can see, wow, it was wonderful that I missed that train that day. Because I missed that train that day, this happened, and this happened, and this happened, and it ended up being a great benediction. And some things you can't see. But after you've seen enough of them, you can get some faith that the things that I can't see, I will understand someday. That someday I'll be able to have the vision that everything is good, and that everything is merciful, and that I got exactly what I needed. And also I'm getting exactly what I need. You know, what I need is not exactly the same as what you need, and what you need, and what you need. So I may think, you know, why does this person get money and I don't? But Krishna understands what my needs are, and he knows what's best for me. As I say, many times we see that after a while. Not always, but. So I was talking to Kalasambhar about that yesterday, huh? You know, some that we were each share swapping stories of where we were very much mistreated by a temple authority, and it ended up to be the greatest benediction from Krishna. It ended up being exactly what we needed. So you take care of children sometimes, right? So do the children always appreciate and feel gratitude for what you do that's for their benefit? No. So do you always make, when you're taking care of children, do you make sure they get everything that they need? Try your best, right? And in fact, you probably try to give them more than just what they need. You'd probably try to give them extra. Now, if you were God, you could actually give them extra and everything that they need. You wouldn't just have to try. And do you sometimes give them what they need in ways that they find uncomfortable? Well, I mean, like they need to sleep. So you have them go to bed. They don't want to go to bed. They're screaming, I don't want to go to bed, I don't want to go to bed. And you know they need to go to bed. So you're meeting their needs, but they don't like the way you're meeting their needs. Or you're making them eat broccoli and they just want to eat cookies. Because you know they have a need for proper vitamins and nutrition. So if we, who are conditioned souls and selfish and have so many problems, if we take care of the needs of the children under our care, then why isn't Krishna taking care of our needs? And just sometimes we don't like the way he does it. Sometimes we're like, why are you giving me broccoli? I want a cookie. Why are you telling me to go to sleep when I want to play? And sometimes, you know, little children sometimes kick and scream about that kind of stuff. They do. And sometimes even yell at their parents, right? Little children, 2-3-year-old children. You're mean, Mommy. I don't like you. I'm going to find another mommy. Bye. I remember when I was 8, I wrote my parents a note that I was running away from home. I said, but you don't have to get the police because I'll be back later. So, you know, sometimes we get angry at Krishna. We're very much like that. We're like little children. Krishna, why aren't you giving me what I want? If you love me, you give me what I want. You could say, well, why doesn't he at least explain it to me? But we can't hear it. I mean, again, I've had the same experience with children. They'll say, why don't you explain it to me? We say, I did explain it to you, but I don't understand it. I said, well, yeah, I explained it to you 5 times. I can't do any better than that. Hopefully, when you're older, you'll understand. Why do I have to study geography? I don't like it. So how do we get faith? See how Krishna is taking care of you. Look around. Notice it. Notice how much you're being taken care of. Notice that you're being taken care of in abundance. Notice that you're being taken care of in excess of what you need. Pretty much consistently. That we're very rarely given just exactly what we need. We're generally given much more. Again, just like most parents, they don't buy their children exactly as many clothes as they need and give them exactly as many toys as they need. They usually give them extra. And we get all sorts of things that aren't needs at all, like flowers. Who needs flowers? We don't need flowers. We don't need beautiful sunrises. I mean, that's not even a need at all. And Krishna gives us that. He gives us things, not only does he give us our needs in abundance, he gives us all sorts of things that are just nice. So you meditate on that, develop some gratitude. Meditate on the fact that the difficult things that in time you've come to understand, at least some of them, right? Hasn't that happened? The things that appear to be not getting what you need, that after some time you said, oh, that was exactly what I needed. And then you can more easily have faith that the things we don't understand now, in time we will understand. In time they will make sense to us. There will come a time when we'll look at them and say, it was all perfect. That everything was exactly perfect. So then the one will have a question that, well, wait a minute, how do I know it's really going to be perfect? Maybe my situation is not Krishna. I get this question a lot. Maybe my situation is not Krishna. Maybe my situation is just due to my material desires. Well, yeah, of course, all of our situations is just due to material desires. But Krishna is also working perfectly in our lives.
Is that okay? Okay, we'll look at this more on Thursday. Anybody else? Yes.
It's probably a correct thing for this, but I found that over time, I go through periods of experiencing an inadequacy, when you start facing yourself, and I kind of find that like a couple of months ago, I was just I felt so full and so disgusted with myself, and it was really affecting my confidence and myself, and actually feeling worthy of practicing Christian consciousness. So like, I was just wondering like how to deal with facing the dust in your own heart.
We talked about this last night at the home program. So an interesting effect of practicing Krishna consciousness is you start seeing yourself honestly. When you first take up Krishna consciousness, most of us tend to think we're far, far better than we are. You know, we think that we're charitable, selfless, loving, caring people who are well motivated. That's basically how materialistic people see themselves. If materialistic people think, well, I mess up my behavior sometimes, but I've got a good heart, I've got good intentions. And as you advance in Krishna consciousness, you see, I generally do the right thing, but my intentions are all lousy. You know, the more you go on with chanting, the more you see that our intentions really are just awful. They're really awful, that the reason I'm doing things is lust, anger, envy, greed, selfishness, you know. And you'll see it more and more and more and more clearly. I mean, you'll really see it. It's like, wow. So, it's... That's actually one of the steps in learning. You know, if you go to a teacher, first you have to understand what you don't know. If you think you already know everything, why would you learn it? You know, you have to be aware of what you don't know. That's called humility. That's part of humility. Why would I be submissive otherwise? So that shouldn't be an impetus for depression and discouragement, but rather it should be an impetus for improving. It's, well, I've really got something to work on here. Now, by the way, we actually can't get rid of all of our narches. We can't actually get rid of any of our narches. And I think some of the discouragement is thinking that I have to do all this. Really, you can't. Also, the discouragement is the mind. the mind is a machine which we are given when we want to be an illusion. You know, like if you want to play a computer game, you get one of those little Xboxes or something. You get some little machine that allows you to play your computer game. So if I want to be an illusion, I get a machine that facilitates me being an illusion. You say to Krishna, I want to be an illusion. So the design of the mind is to keep you in illusion. So the mind is constantly, that's its function, and we wanted it. We can't blame Krishna for it. We wanted it, we demanded it. So the mind is constantly saying, look at that. Look at that. Don't look at Krishna. Yeah, he's nice. But now look at that. I look at that. I look at that. I look at that. And as we advance, the mind also gives us stuff. So as you progress and you start to see, wow, I've really fallen. I thought I was a nice person. I mean, I really thought I was. But I'm not. You know, just remembering, one of my students gave me a beautiful chadar that is, it was from Nepal, that his mother had sent. And I thought, wow, I got this beautiful chadar from Nepal. I'm so special. I'm so loved. And I wore it to the temple the next morning, and I looked around, and guess what I saw? All the other women in the temple had one of those chadars, and mother had set one for everybody. And I was so upset. I'm sitting there chanting Hare Krishna externally, and I'm just like seething. And very quickly, it was like, oh, I'm envious. And this is hard to admit, but until that day, I didn't know I was envious. I actually didn't know. I thought envy was some problem that other people had. I didn't know I had it. And I was like, wow, I'm actually envious. Ooh. Wow. And I'm really envious. So then the mind says, when those things happen, then the mind chips in and says, see? See, it's impossible. You should just be depressed. Just give up this, don't do this Krishna consciousness. If you do this Krishna consciousness, you'll see how fallen you are, and then you'll just get really depressed. Go back to illusion, and you won't know how fallen you are anymore. You'll pretend that you're not envious. So, weren't you happier before you knew you were envious? Just go back to that. That's what the mind says, and we sometimes have been used to following my mind. Let's just go back to that. But really what's happening is like this. So in the Bhagavad Gita, there's four steps. One, Arjuna gets close to Krishna, which is really what we're talking about today. Touching, getting close. Arjuna gets close to, I surrender, I'll be your disciple. Then Krishna says, okay, first thing I'm going to tell you is you're a fool. And I'm going to show you reality. What is reality? Krishna, Maya, and me. Krishna's three main energies. Chit Shakti, Maya Shakti, Jiva Shakti. Krishna's going to show you, here I am. Here, how beautiful, how wonderful, how playful I am. Here's Maya. Envy, lust, anger, greed, selfishness, cruelty. And here's you. So that's what he does to Arjuna. He says, here's the soul, this is what the soul's like. This is how you become conditioned. This is the nature of Maya. This is my nature. And then at the end, what does he say? Now? Do what you want. Now choose. He says, if you choose me, I will help you. I will deliver you. And if you choose Maya, you're going to be lost. So we come close to Krishna by chanting, by serving the deity, by serving the devotees, by cleaning the temple and floor, by taking prasada. When we come close to Krishna, things become revealed to us. And those three things are revealed, me, Maya, and Krishna. Now, the first me that is revealed is a very dirty me, Cheto Darpana Marjana. When I first look in the mirror, I see a very mud-covered me. And it's possible to just kind of focus on the mud. That's the me that I see. And Krishna says, okay, here you go. Now choose. What do you want? Do you want to keep the mud or do you want to get rid of the mud? In order to help us get rid of the mud, he shows us how awful it is. Suppose you're cleaning out your room and you haven't cleaned your room for, 20 years. And it's so bad that you have to invite a friend over to help you because it's just, you feel overwhelmed. You look at all the dirt and you're like, I can't do this. Where do I start? And your friend comes and your friend says, what's this? It's moldy. It's... What is this? You say, oh, that's from my great-grandmother. I can't throw that away. Your friend says, but it stinks. And then you say, okay, throw it. You can't throw it away because it's from your great-grandmother. You just can't bear to do it. But you can say, here, you throw it. I'll give you permission to throw it away. So that's what Krishna does. He shows you, look at what you're doing. You think that you're doing some wonderful service. You think that you're doing some this and that, but actually it's just envy. It's just lust. It's just selfishness. And our response to that should be disgust. Not at me, but at what I'm holding on to. Maybe some disgust at me that I'm stupid enough to hold on to it, but that's... Krishna's saying, you're holding on, he's showing you, you're holding on to this thing. Why? Not so we just go, oh. But so we say, oh, I don't want to hold on to this thing anymore. Blech. And then what does he do? He takes it away. Now, he's not going to take it away as long as you're holding on to it. He's not going to force. Krishna's not a rapist. He's a lover. He's not going to force. He's just not going to force. If you're holding on, that's not what he wants you to do. And often that's what we do. Krishna's surface is envy. We say, oh, I don't want that. I don't want that. I don't want that. And then it keeps coming back. When Krishna shows you have some attachment and your response is just, well, I don't want that. And you push it away and then it keeps coming back. You're like, it keeps coming back. No, what you have to do is say, oh, I want this. You own it. You follow? You admit. You don't lie to Krishna and say, oh, I don't want this. That's a lie. You do want it. That's why it's there. He's trying to show you, you want this. So, oh, I want this. Ew. Why do I want this? What do I think it's going to give me? Lord, show me why I'm attached to this thing. Instead of just denying it, like those people last night who said, I love Krishna unconditionally, you know? Or no, I don't want to be lusty. Hey? You know, it says the demons, kama ashrita, they take shelter of lust, and ahankar ashrita, they take shelter of ahankar. So I'm taking shelter of my envy, of my lust, of my greed. I'm actually like, it's protecting me. So I say, Krishna, show me why I'm holding on to this. And then he'll show you more. That process will be bittersweet. It will be sweet because you're relating with Krishna. And it'll be bitter because you have to recognize and admit what fool you are. If you just look at this stuff and deny it, it's only bitterness. But if you realize that Krishna is showing that you're starting to have a relationship with Krishna when that happens. He's starting to trust you. Which of your friends can you tell that they have a problem? Only your friends who trust you. How many friends do each of us have that we can honestly tell them what their biggest problems are? Probably not very many. And even those, probably not often. We couldn't do it daily. They would never talk to us again. So if somebody is telling us, revealing to us what our problems are, that means they're hoping that we trust them. They're starting to establish an authentic relationship. A relationship based on something that's real. So you celebrate that. Wow, Krishna's trusting me. I've been saying over and over, I want to serve you, I want to serve you, I want to love you, I want to serve you, I want to love you, I want to serve you, I want to love you, I want to serve you, I want to love you. And he starts to believe us. And he says, okay, here's a problem. This is a block between you and me. This is a problem in our relationship. And the response he wants from us is, wow, Lord, you're trusting me enough to tell me something that's very painful and difficult for me. And you're trusting that I'm going to respond in a loving, grateful way instead of in a shameful way. Instead of just feeling ashamed and denying and hiding. No, I'm not. That's not what I'm a victim. That's just Maya doing that to me. He wants us to own it. He said, thank you, Lord, for having enough faith in me. That you're willing to show me this thing. Now, show me more. And he'll show you more. And he'll say, the reason you're holding on to this is you think it's going to do this for you. You think it's going to do this for you. And you look at it and you go, oh, it's actually not doing those things for me. You'll become convinced in your heart. And he'll keep giving you as much knowledge as you need until you say, okay, I'm ready to let it go. And that may take 1 minute. It may take 10 minutes. It may take a week. And then you say, okay, I'm ready to let it go. Not here. Not I'm ready to let it go. But you actually, I'm actually ready to let this go. I don't need this. It's not helping me. And letting go of an attachment, it takes a kind of faith that I don't know is going to come next. That was one Christian minister, he said, when you come to the end of the light that you have to trust that in the darkness, either there's going to be solid ground or you're going to be cat caught. Or you're going to learn how to fly. So there's a certain jump you make. It's only that long. It's only a moment. It looks really scary. It looks like, ooh, when I give this up, what will I have? This has been my shelter for so long. It's a bad shelter. Durashraya. It's a bad shelter. It's actually hurting me. It's not giving me what I want. It's hurting me. But it's all I know. You know, like people staying in abusive relationships kind of thing. Well, at least I know it. Or people continuing to drink alcohol when they're addicted. What will I do without it? I remember one of my old high school friends said, what will I do with my hands if I don't smoke? So that's kind of where we are, you know. What will I... I mean, I remember one devotee saying, if I give up lust, how will I be motivated to maintain my family? Get this question. Oh, time. But if I gave up my material attachments, I would lose my motivation for action. I wouldn't do anything. I'd become, this is the mind, by the way. That's the business of the mind. The mind is saying, if you gave up this material attachment, you'd lose your discrimination. You'd become foolish. You'd become a robot. You'd become some kind of brainwashed cult member. Or you wouldn't want to do anything anymore. You would just sit around. You wouldn't care about anything anymore. You need this envy to care. You need greed to care. You need lust to care. You've got to hold on to it. That's what the mind's saying. You look at the mind and you say, this is illusion. I don't know how I'm going to be motivated. I don't know how I'm going to get my pleasure. I don't know how I'm going to get my shelter without this. I don't know yet, but I'm going to try it anyway because this is so awful. And then I say, okay, I trust you. Take it. Takes it. And then it's like you just took a bath. And everything is just given to you. And you're like, wow, why did I wait so long? Now, have we had this experience over and over again? Whatever it was that we gave up that we were attached to. And it was like, wow, I feel free. And I have everything that I need, much better than when I was holding on to it. So if you respond that way, then guess what Krishna will do? Then he'll show you the next thing. 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 But after you get rid of a certain amount of things, guess what starts to happen? After you start cleaning up a lot of your junk, your room starts to look clean. You start to see what your room actually looks like. So after you let go of enough of these things, pretty soon, when you look in the mirror of the heart, you're not going to see the mud anymore. What are you going to see? Yourself, and who are you? You're wonderful. Reading what Prabhupada said, we are not actually materially contaminated at all. Maya is only within the mind. 14th chapter of Krishna book. Maya is within the mind. I think I'm envious, I'm lusty, I'm greedy. I'm not any of that stuff. I'm just holding on to something that's not me. And you start to see I'm wonderful. And then the devotees pray, how merciful my Lord is that such a fallen person as me, he is made into one of his associates. So if you respond in the way I'm describing to Krishna showing you you're an artist, your advancement will be very fast. What stops people's advancement is when Krishna shows them you're an artist, they get depressed. You know, they just spend all the time kind of looking at it. You see, it's again a human relationship. So if your wife says to you, look, it really bothers me that as soon as you come home from work, you just go in your room and close the door. I feel like you don't love me. I wish when you come home, you at least would take 5 minutes to say hello and ask me how I've been, and then you can go in your room and close the door. And if the man responds with, why are you always just criticizing me? Why are you getting on my case? You know, he just feels guilty. Then it widens the gap between them, and she's not going to want to be honest with him next time. But if he says, oh, does that really bother you? Have I been hurting you by doing that? I didn't know I was hurting you. Now that I'm aware that I'm hurting you, I'll try to do something to heal the relationship. So that's what you want. So that's what Krishna wants. Krishna wants us to say, oh, I've been hurting you? I'm sorry. I'd like to not hurt you anymore. And then it's bittersweet. There's some bitterness there. There's some humility, bitterness, some humble bitterness that you have to say, yeah, I hurt you. And you have to feel that. Otherwise, again, it's not genuine. If I go, yeah, I hurt you, no, you gotta feel it. But it's part of reestablishing the relationship, and that's so sweet. So sweet. And gradually, it becomes more and more about reestablishing the relationship because there's less and less blocks in the way. And after a while, there's only the relationship, there isn't any blocks. Is that all right? thank you very much. All glories to Sri Guru.